LNE Volume 3, a video by the great Franklin Carbonati, spanning Rome, Milan, London, New York, Paris, Barcelona, Montreal, and Toronto, featuring Rebo, Volvo, Snens, MTNW, Anger, Talker, Xavier, BO South, Lure, Rehab, Time, Zonic, XSM, Kemto, Salon, TD, Emno, Fayer, Toser, Nove, Stays, Villo, OSF, Waste, Soul, Zano, Guko, and What. The full video is now available on our Patreon. Enjoy, peace, love, and respect. All right, boom, fucking, we're live. What up, yo? We got Joe Hardcore. I'm super, super excited to have you on the show today. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you so much for doing
this. Man, thank you for having us, man.
Yeah,
I'm really excited to be on this.
Yeah,
I like your shirt.
Yo, thank you, man.
True Path Grappling.
You know about the True Path?
Yeah, it's my boy.
That's your boy, right? You know him, Jordan?
Yeah, Rude Awakening.
Rude Awakening and shit. Hell yeah, yeah. Dude, I got the shirt off him, got the poster and all that. He's doing really amazing things with that, with all that thing that he's doing.
Inspiring a lot of people, yeah.
Yeah, 100%. So, I guess we're just going to start off with your upbringing. You're born and raised in Philadelphia, correct?
Yes, born and raised. I was born on July 4th in 1980, which is, like, pretty epic in Philadelphia for fireworks. We have a huge, I would say a huge legacy of being, like, the home of, you know, July 4th. So it was kind of sick, you know, and coming up as a kid. I was born in Fishtown, lived in Kensington until my mom and dad split, and then basically I had family who lived in Kensington. I lived in Frankfurt, which, New York, you guys have subways. We have an elevated train that has a little bit of a subway. So we lived all along this L train, like, and very loud, you know, but it was, you know, across 8 different stops is where my entire family ran. And I would say that, you know, in the beginning, it was a little hectic. We didn't have a lot of money. My mother had me when she was 16, turning 17. You know, until she had me, she was a young maniac climbing on the L trains, writing graffiti. You know, like, and then all of a sudden, boom! Oh yeah, she's gonna be a mother. And I think it was a little overwhelming. My father was not very a good person. Very talented in woodworking. For not being a smart person, he had this idiot savant kind of way with measurements, mathematics, laying shit out. But other than that, he was an abysmal father, abusive. And eventually, between first just fucking around with drugs, later dealing drugs, and then finally on drugs like crack cocaine. And that really kind of put my mother, myself, and later my sister, who's 3 years younger than me, kind of in the path that we were through. From the time I would say my sister came along when I was 3, by the time I was 7, we were living, me and my mother and my sister were living in an apartment next door to her aunt and uncle, and it wasn't a good neighborhood. My mom, obviously, she didn't even have a GED, so, you know, she had to make things happen for us. And I mean, it was a lot of pancake breakfasts, pancake dinners. You know, there was a lot of times when we didn't have certain utilities. You know, and I mean, we're talking like having to share the hot water. There was a lot of that early on. And eventually what my mother did was she started putting herself through GED, which when she did that, she would take me to the library local to us in Frankfurt. And that kind of put me on the path of reading books and began kicking my young brain off. And my mother did a lot to make sure that my sister and I just got through. And the neighborhood wasn't great, and we didn't have a father figure. There was dudes in and out. My mom, obviously being 22, 23, she was the best that she could be for a young 20-year-old girl, you know? And at some point, she actually even started stripping on the side just because she couldn't keep money coming in. And it's this weird story, but it's like my mom one day came up to me. She's like, hey, I got to tell you this so that way, if somebody in our family or someone says to me, hey, you know, your mother takes her clothes off for a living, this is what I have to do to make sure we can afford this place. And But, like, that's the one side of a coin. The other side of a coin is she took us to the park whenever she could. You know, there was a lot of cool shit. I always joke around now and put a lighter side on it. Like, my mom grew up into hair metal, into, like, 80s stuff. So we had a lot of girls in my house that run around, like, 80s metal. So you have, like, this whole different environment, which eventually would kick off everything that would be me musically. Because, you know, when she had to work on the weekends, my older cousin, whose mom and dad lived next door, would come over and watch me and my sister in return for his friends being able to play Dungeons & Dragons. So you have these 80s long hair metal people who are playing Dungeons & Dragons, and I got to stay up on Saturday nights to watch Headbangers Ball. That was like, after Headbangers Ball, you got to go to bed. And that, on top of just the hair metal and the different like music and the different dudes that were coming into my mom's life, would put me on the path musically, like what I was into. And so everything that I am is a result of the work of my mother, and there's so much early influence musically in just the shit that she exposed us to, from taking me to early concerts, you know, and then later just the dudes that would come in and you'd see t-shirts, and it's just like the hardcore scene thing where you'd say, oh, look at that guy's cool shirt, and you would ask him. My mother would eventually get a GED and eventually start putting herself through community college programs. She met somebody who was from Canada, a dude named Brian, and he made me a tape when she found out I was into heavy metal. It had Agnostic Front, it had Carnivore, it had all this stuff, and I wore this tape completely out. And that was like really the basis for a lot of the beginnings of me finding out about hardcore music. And so in the late 80s, we were dealing with a major crack epidemic, and our neighborhood wasn't great. And thankfully, at that time, we lived next door to my Uncle Bill, who has more guns than any human being alive. His AOL name is straight up Wild Bill 357. Like, and he's like this old former cop maniac. And that dude's the only reason why I think, like, we were able to live on the block, you know? It wasn't easy. I mean, you had no father figure, really. We had the, early on, when I was young and not in school, we'd have to sit in the welfare lines, like physically sit in the welfare line with my mom, get actual food stamps, not a card, like Monopoly money looking food stamps. And I remember like going to stores and having this money in my hands and trying to hide it as I'm paying out. And then one time my friend saw me, he's like, oh yeah, my mom's on food stamps. And then it hit me like, oh shit, our whole neighborhood's also on food stamps. But yeah, a lot of the stuff that would get me excited about hardcore, and it was comes through metal and comes through just being angry at our situation, you know. And then like, it's 1990, I'm starting to grow my hair out. I play soccer all the time, but I'm listening to Metallica every day. I'm starting to find out what death metal is.
Did you have friends who were into that scene as well, or it was just like you with the tape getting into it on your own?
I literally had older cousins who played Dungeons and Dragons and their friends. And around that time, there were some people whose parents might like Aerosmith. And so I got called Dusty Joe because I had long hair. I had to fight a lot because I was literally like a pip on a domino in some classes. You know, I'm like the only white kid with a long hair. So I had to fight a lot after school, and I didn't win a lot of fights. My mom eventually would just say, look, you got to stop running. You got to fight these kids. I don't care if you have to fight them all one-on-one. It kind of put you on that like crazy path of like, it's one of my things where now it's like, I guess we're just going to fight right here. And I grew up also loving the 1970s Broad Street Bullies era of the Flyers. I played a lot of like Milex street hockey. We didn't have a lot of money, so we didn't have all the fucking nicest pads, you know, like we played on a corner. We never, you know, this time roller, what are them single rollerblades? We didn't even have them. We didn't have, you know, we played on our feet. But I kind of just started embodying the grab the shirt and just punch this person more than they could punch me as a kind of way. And eventually these kind of kids were kind of like, all right, this crazy white dude's just not going to stop, you know? And then when like Vanilla Ice and all this shit started coming out is really when a couple people started popping their heads up. Yo, I listened to this too. but they had like short hair. And my rebellion was kind of going into full thing. I had my mom was dating this guy who got me into everything from like the Ramones to the, this band Wasp. He was taking us to more concerts because he was in a heavy metal band. It kind of even put me further. And eventually I did meet older friends who lived on the other side of the railroad tracks. Like the L train is behind my mom's house. Like one block we're there. And then my friends were on the other side of the tracks. But they were like, I was 11. They were 13, 14, 15. And my mom's whole mentality was like, because she at the time was no longer stripping. She was still putting herself through college. But she was also working at this bar and booking metal bands. Like hair metal bands and thrash bands. She was like, I don't care what you do. Go to, like, she would rather see me at concerts.
Yeah.
Than sitting at home.
So she would encourage you to go to hardcore shows.
Well, I don't think that we even knew what we were going to at first. Like, my first hardcore show was Sick of It All, Biohazard, and Sheer Terror opening. Mm-hmm. And it was on this street called South Street in Philadelphia. And the only reason why we knew about it was it's one of the main venues in the city, and there's posters all over. So with that group of older kids who were into heavy metal, I was able to go to South Street Friday nights and sometimes Saturdays, and we would all go as a group together. You got to understand, like, I mean, you guys from New York, like, that was a world away from the 8 L stops of our neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
That was like 14 stops before you got up and you're like, oh shit, it's downtown. You know,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
I only been downtown for school trips. I never just went downtown. So that kind of put me in that path. And so, then it was, you're looking at so much stuff. You just, it's like a whole different world. Like, kind of like if someone looked at the internet in 1996 and was like, oh my God, look at all this. For us, it was like, look at this guy's patch. Look at these posters on the wall. Mm-hmm. Look at these flyers. Look at these tapes. Like, you could never consume enough.
Yeah, yeah.
So, all of that led me to want to not go to my local school for high school. I took a school downtown, and that was it. It was over. Because I had already started meeting people because we were going to shows. Mm-hmm. My friends would be eventually, most of them become like basement stoner types. We might watch UFC together. That, like, you know, we might watch WrestleMania and stuff all together. But like, I wanted to get out of the neighborhood. I mean, our neighborhood wasn't the worst, but it wasn't the best. But then in the beginning of the 90s, more shootings happened. There were straight up like legit problems because we weren't little kids no more. We were now in our teens, so, you know, we were long hairs in a fucking bad neighborhood.
Mm. You feel me? Actually, like,
then what's up?
Oh, I'm sorry to cut you off. There's actually a page on Instagram. It's called Philly Housing Projects. I don't know if you know about it.
Yeah,
he documents like current events of what goes on in like Kensington, for example. And like, dude, it's insane.
It's raw,
every post he posts is like people laying on the sidewalk, like shooting up, like garbage all over the place, man. It's, I can only imagine back in the days what it was like, if that's how it's on going on now, you know.
Bizarre enough, the couple L stops, Huntington L stop was the big one. My mother's family and my father's family, both sides of their family, all live within like a city block of each other. And a lot of my mother's family left for Florida, which is ironic as fuck, because they were fucking around with crack. So crack started ripping out the neighborhood. Well, that came first. At the time, we were very aware across the whole system that, I mean, there was open prostitution, there was burned out cars. If you see the first two Rockies, that neighborhood is right where all that drug shit is now. So at the end of the 70s and early 80s, it wasn't as bad as it got. What happened is the drugs, the lack of jobs, and the overall, fuck it, it doesn't matter if it happens in Kensington, drove the neighborhood people away from the neighbors. So that way, with the double trouble of the opioid epidemic, it's actually gotten worse. So in the middle of the 90s, it was wild. But it was not at this, like, infestation level. It wasn't until the beginning of the 2000s, but really started kicking up around 2010. And it's orchestrated to push gentrification. And it's orchestrated because you have a large swath of land that was built with these small row homes, 40 city homes on each side of a street. So you have 100 homes, between two streets. You had these industrial factories where these people were having jobs. Those are gone. You know, like all of our neighborhoods are small. You had the factories that went away, so you had nothing but churches, row homes, and hopefully your parents had jobs, otherwise your own welfare. And that went, that's a huge swath of Philadelphia. Like, it's our city, people always come to Philly and they're like, oh shit, it's actually really big, but it's like the people that come from out of town, they go downtown or they go to certain places, like the center of the city has always looked crazy. It's called like North Philadelphia, and like that area specifically was called the Badlands. Like, so the year 2000, Philadelphia wouldn't even get rid of burned out cars, broken cars. So like my childhood was playing around and like, you know, going neighborhood to neighborhood, and you'd see burned out cars, you'd see stray dogs and crazy shit. Yeah. And
they would just leave the cars there on the street.
Yeah. They don't have the money. They had no, what are we going to do with them? So we'd be in the cars playing around like we were in them and shit. And like, we played a lot of, like, younger on, we played a lot of games like step ball, where you basically throw a ball against a step. And depending on how far the ball goes, it's a single, double, triple, or home run. And we had wire ball and we had wall ball. And we just played with what the environment was, because a lot of the parks was where they were selling drugs, you know? And it was not easy unless, you know, like, it was a very urban environment that was directly left to fester and get worse, in hopes that the people who actually own homes would sell them. And a lot of the parts of the neighborhood where my mother and I were at were sold to Section 8. So you get your money no matter what, it doesn't matter. So then that only made the people who did take care of their houses want to get the fuck out. So between 1990 and 2000... the whole neighborhood swath just got worse and worse. And then the people who left, they never even wanted to go back. By 2000, there was starting to be some interest by these people who basically set up gentrification. I believe they're called like the New Kensington Development Company. And their whole point was to bring in all the bullshit gentrification with no help in the neighborhood. So most of the people who are living in Kensington now and Fishtown and Port Richmond and Frankfort, a lot of these people aren't even the people that were there 20 years ago. They're the you know, like, they haven't been there 40 years. There are people that are still there, but not as many, because a lot of people who could get out got out. Everyone else died, went to jail, and now these newer people come in and they're just as crazy, or they're just a trap, you know. And it's just there to expose and get more people away. That's why the L Stop Somerset was always bad, and you never got off at that street, you know. But like, later on, as I, you know, went from being like a kid to like a teenager, I moved back straight up in Kensington, so I had to walk all those blocks. I had to, and I would see it. And throughout my 20s into my 30s, I was living in Kensington, Port Richmond area the whole time. And it just got progressively worse. You'd see hookers eating out of trash. You'd see a couple people doped up. And then in 2012-13, they were straight up just starting to live right out in the street. Now, what happened recently, which is another huge fucking reason why you see everybody out in the streets, gentrification had come in. Houses are literally going, I'm not exaggerating, you could buy a house for $8,000 in 2002. Those houses were renovated and sold for $300,000. They used this out-of-state investment from people from New York who just were buying up houses with a 25-year tax abatement. So as this $300,000, $400,000 house, white people start showing up. They're like, oh, we shouldn't have all these people living on this abandoned railroad track. Ipso facto, they get the railroad tracks cleaned up. And now the motherfuckers all over the street living under. There's a railroad track that was used to bring items, like industrial items, across through the city and down to the river to the ports. We have a huge river port not far from there. So what happened is when the drugs, they would just literally live like villains on this one area. When we were writing graffiti, we knew, you know, stay together, write the shit, you know, whatever. And no, we didn't fuck with them. They would fuck with you. But they were just on dope. And the other side of the railroad tracks, the Badlands, was straight up always open-air drug sales, and no one gave a fuck about it. these fucking people from out of town buying $400,000 row homes. Oh, we need to do something. So they cleaned up the railroad tracks, and they literally spilled the mess all over. Yeah, that's why you see it now.
That's similar, actually, what's going on right now in New York with this whole corona thing. A lot of homeless people used to live on the trains, but they have this thing now where the trains aren't...
From 1 to 5,
you can't go on the train from 1 a.m. to 5 a.m., so they've kicked out all the homeless people off the trains, and they're all over the streets now. And another thing is, like, the jail is, like, they're saying they're all overpopulated or something, they're letting people out. You know, so there's, like, a lot of people coming out now on the streets that you wouldn't see before, you know, so it's, like, similar to what you're saying.
Yeah, our L stopped running, like, around 12:15 was the last one, and they have these bus shuttles. Because, I mean, obviously New York is, like, 8 times more populated than Philadelphia. So, like, the need for late-night shit is way more of a New York thing. But, like, if you didn't get on the L, you had to sit on that bus, and that was crazy. But they wouldn't let the homeless on the bus, obviously. So it wasn't as bad, but it's orchestrated. It's a way to move out poor people from an area that makes sense where they could redevelop it with no thought or care to what happens 100%. To us.
Definitely no care.
You know, like, yeah. It's bullshit.
Yeah,
it's sad.
No, it's very sad.
But in terms of that,
but,
like, that's...
But I'll tell you what, like, the other side of it is so, like, my group of friends would eventually be the first couple people I was meeting at shows. We would get on a Bridger Pratt, which is, like, the big station. The only way you get out any further... They had the buses that would go to that area. So people would meet up. So by L train number 8, there's 30 or 40 of us. And we're dressed in the most shitty, like, I don't know, like, I would say you could call it half grunge, half punk rock, half heavy metal. No one had the money for Doc Martens. And there were skinheads who were running around and straight up cut Doc Martens off fresh cut. So no one was like, oh, we ain't wearing Doc Martens. Fuck that. You know, but like you would, all the neighborhood people were finding hardcore out, all kind of found each other between 94 and 95. We would all go to shows together and we're like swinging, kicking windows. Everyone's drinking on the L train. Like, I wouldn't trade that chaos for anything. You know, like later on, there was a venue in Chinatown. And when we got kicked out of the show, it was a big fight. We all go, we fuck up this Wawa, we get on the train, we're kicking, literally, we're kicking glass out of the L train. It's all plastic glass, so it just all comes out at once. Dudes are learning how to use the hydraulics under the seat to open the doors up, and it was just chaos. But it was like 40 of us on a train, like a scene out of that, you know, the Warriors.
Jumping around and shit.
Yeah, literally, we're fucking just like fucking up the L train, and then we would get off, throw eggs at hookers, run around all night, and it was like a fun thing for us to kind of like. It was a huge part of the chaos factor. Is I think all that group of friends were all just pent up from the same neighborhood environment, but then you know, as hardcore kind of exposed you. I got really into the culture, and a lot of them dudes are kind of like, nah, I just want to sit in the neighborhood, drink beer, and get into fights. So, you know, you didn't see them dudes as much, but I think the platform of Philadelphia being so crazy and the neighborhoods that where we were from kind of added this level of chaos, like why I could do some of my earlier shows in venues where if all the windows would get broken out, there was like 3 cop cars that would come. You know, like we got away with shit, and we got to live a different way, which... I don't want to fuck up your timeline, but like eventually we're the Young Turks. We're all fucking maniacs. All these people doing shows in Philly hardcore, they're from the suburbs, but they had a college or they lived here. And they're like, oh, where are you guys from? We're like, we're from Philly. You motherfuckers are invading. You know, like, and we really kind of took shit over because we were actually from here and we were fucking crazier. And there was like 40 of us from the neighborhoods. I wouldn't trade that part for a world as much as it kind of aggravates me that we never, like, I was lucky I was in a mentally gifted program. I was lucky my mother took me to a library. I was lucky that I grew up reading books and playing Dungeons and Dragons and being exposed to heavy metal. But, you know, there's actual full generations of Philadelphians who lived between that entire area that never got a regular life because it wasn't available. The schools got worse. You know, you get naturalized to a lot of shit that human beings shouldn't have to go through, you know, outward violence and open drug sales and, you know, everything from like when you're a little kid, you know who's on the L as a prostitute, you know, like it's not your average growing up. and your average environment to grow up.
So within that environment and you getting into hardcore, when did you realize that hardcore was this thing that you really wanted to, it was something that was going to more or less start being a giant part of your life? And how did that help you deal with all the insanity that was going down?
When I lived in Frankfurt and I was like 12, 13 years old, all my boys played Dungeons and Dragons. We would street wrestle. We would hang in the cemeteries and drink 40s and throw eggs and rocks at cars and listen to heavy metal in our basement. And then, you know, straight up sitting on top of the cemetery, because we were headbangers. We can't hang at the park. We'll get fucking jumped. So we hung in the cemetery and we threw rocks at cars and made them try to chase us. And I went to that Biohazard Sick of It All show and it was just like, yo, these motherfuckers are crazy. And I liked that tension, scared atmosphere. Reminded me of just walking around down in our area when there's like six of us and we see this other group like, oh shit, is this on? Are we going to get chased? Are we going to... We didn't win. We ran a lot. But we knew how to climb fences and did crazy shit. You know, but like we didn't get the... You know, like we were the eight long hairs in an entire crazy neighborhood with like even like the white kids were all like about blunts and like, yo, fuck y'all that, why are you over here, come on crazy devil worshippers, you know, like that was our squad. Those guys stayed in the basement of my friend's mother's house and drank more, played more Dungeons and Dragons, played more Vampire, and I loved that fucked up energy of shows. And music was my escape. You know, music was, you know, the classic life is bad, so you're at home with a poster covered walls listening to music, and you're the only... I felt for a long time I was the only person that felt the way I did. I felt I was the only person that had this much anger. And then you go to a show and you'd see all this crazy shit. And then, like, one of the bigger weird things that happened is at the heavy metal shows we were going to, there'd be skinheads straight up Sig Heiling. And you'd just be like, all right, well, we're white, so we didn't, like, oh my God, this is bad. We didn't know anything different. Like, holy shit, there's, like, these crazy skinheads. You know, there was not that many movies about skinheads, but we knew what the shit was. But at that Sick of It All Biohazard show, people were straight up jumping Nazis, and we were like, oh my fucking God. People fight these people? What the fuck? Like, five skinheads could go into a metal show and run the pit. And we'd be like, fuck, these guys are here. This is going to suck. But at a hardcore show, straight up jumping them, and I'm like, this is the craziest shit. Like, who does this? You know, like, and then as I kind of realized, like, I had a couple older friends from the neighborhood. Chris, Straight Edge Chris, Chris X, who works at This Is Hardcore. I literally met him when I was 13 years old. You know, like, them dudes were, I think he's 43 or 44 this year. I just turned 40. So he already had a little bit of a better idea what was going on. My boy Freight Train, they were that age. So they were a couple years ahead of me. So they, like, all right, come on, stay with us. And we were all the dudes that didn't fall back in that partying in the neighborhoods. And we were, like, got way more immersed in hardcore. So what I didn't know, I could ask those guys, you know. And our old heads became the dudes from Bad Luck 13. And they were kind of like, all right, you guys are crazy? Fuck it, we like you. And one of my boys, Bushy, he was the same age as the older dudes. He was, like, the scene dude. Like, he knew the hardcore scene people, you know, like, so he would explain all the beefs and be like, yo, we're gonna go to the show, we see Nazis, we're gonna fuck them up. I'm like, all right, that's cool, we'll fuck these guys up. And I can remember Dennis from Bad Luck's like, look, see that guy over there, you guys are gonna hit him and we're gonna fuck everybody up. So, like, being the young Turks, we had, like, the kind of, like, invincibility that a 16-year-old would have, and it kind of put us into that position. And then because I had older friends, especially Steve Bush, yo, he had the internet, which I only had one other friend who had the internet, and he had, like, Prodigy or AOL. So Bushy was on the hardcore chat room, which I'm like, I don't understand what this is. He's like, well, yeah, you talk via the computer. And he knew about all this beefs and shit we had no idea about. And, like, we understood beefs because we had graffiti crews. Like, we all had our, like, shit that we did. You know, everyone had corners and shit. But, like, we didn't understand, like, wait, hardcore people have crews? Like, what the fuck? You know, and, like, that became a huge part of the early teens. Was, like, you know, you had a lot of different small crews in Philly and New Jersey. So we started traveling because Bushy could literally get these random girls he met off the internet to literally pick him up and just drive him to shows. So we started going to shows in New Jersey, and we were going up to the Pipeline in Newark, New Jersey. We're going to New Brunswick. We're going to these places. We're going to Lansdowne, Pennsylvania, CeCe's in Moosic, which is like 2 hours away in the fucking mountains. And there were a couple of our friends' bands. One of them was Kensington. Another one was Forsaken Existence, who New Jersey. We started meeting all these people from this area, and they all have these hardcore bands. And they start playing far. So, okay, I guess we're traveling when they travel. And it really exposed us to not only the Philly hardcore scene or the South Jersey hardcore scene, but, like, yo, we went to New York, and we were like, yo, this is just a different environment. You guys mosh different. People in New York smoked the entire time they moshed, which we had hall shows and shit. You didn't see that as much. There's a totally different cultural experience. But I went all in, you know. Another big part of my life was a changing factor. I was 15 and a virgin. My mom, I remember, forget it. 2 years before that, we had our first boy girl party. And we're all outside playing hacky sack like headbangers. And my mom's like, why aren't you pussies in talking to these girls? I'm like, I don't know. And she's like, listen, I'm not going to use the word because we don't want to be canceled here, but don't be at the blank. Pussy's pussy, go for the girl with the bigger tits. And we're like, all right, cool. So we went in, that's how we started talking to girls. Fast forward to high school, I meet this girl. She has awesome boobs, and that ended up being the first girl I ever had sex with. And literally, I ended up knocking up a girl who was 19 when I was 15 years old. So I had to quit high school.
So you got her pregnant.
What's that?
You got her pregnant.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I had to quit high school, get a job at a bowling alley. We got an apartment over top of the bar where my mom worked at. My boy Carmen, RIP, he became like my roommate, and we worked at a bowling alley. We listened to hardcore music, and just was like, there was this existential dread of my life is over. But all I had was listening to hardcore music at that time. And because there was like a 4 month period where I literally just work, listen to music, maybe go to a show. She was really controlling because obviously I'm 16 years old. She's like 20. Be like, you can't go out. You got to work. And I remember being like, this is the end of my life. And then they were like, yo, Agnostic Front is getting back together. And growing up, I got told I missed everything because I never saw this band. You never saw the Pagan Babies. You never saw Turning Point. You miss everything. I'm like, fuck, I missed everything in hardcore. This sucks. So my mom, God bless her soul, I'm 16 years old. My boy Carmen's 18. She got us tickets to the second day of the Agnostic Front reunions in the wetlands. We go up there. I see this show, and I came back. I'm like, that's it. Fuck this. I'm not giving up on hardcore. I don't care what she says. I'm still going to do shows. Like, this is my whole life. Like, you know, like, that reinvigorated me. Like, seeing, like, I don't know why, because, like, a little kid, literally 16 years old, literally, like, yo, man, Agnostic Front is back. I can't just stop going to shows. I don't care if I'm a kid. I got to still do this shit. And my life was pretty dysfunctional most of my childhood, so I understand a fucked up childhood upbringing. Me and her obviously didn't work out too well, and that same time frame was 1997. My mom had a lot of very wild, sketchy friends, and they let us rent a hall. I put on my very first show, March of 1997. Previous to this, we would go to different venues, and there was one venue, the Chinatown one called The Friends, where we went and see Max on Penalty, and like no one showed up. Now, mind you, in our local neighborhood, there was churches and this YWCA, where like three local brands would bring 90 people. So me being a smart ass was like, we could bring more people just with our own bands. And they're like, he gave me these hard little fucking tickets. He's like, get me four bands and I'll give you a date and you guys could do a show. And that became the beginning of us doing shows at there. But I wasn't a band, so I got my friends' bands and then we all figured out how to do it. I would later be in the worst band ever that thank God doesn't have the internet because it's embarrassing how bad it is. There's no digital recordings. No one will hopefully ever hear this band because it was just this horrible how bad we were. But we did get to play with 25 to Life, who never showed up. The Suburban Hoods, who would become my boy to this day, Jeff Stress, DJ Stress. And
he does jujitsu too, right? I met the
Dysphoria dudes. What's that?
He does jujitsu as well.
Well, yeah, I got him into jiu-jitsu by choking him.
Yeah, I heard about that, yeah.
But, that's how, I mean, like, I met that dude when I was 15, and now we're on the mats together. Sick. As adults.
So good.
But what happened is I put the same kind of show we had before on, and we had a hall, and that became, like, me doing shows. And it was November 97. I had 25 to life, overthrow from Long Island, the dudes from New Jersey, all of our boys, and it was the biggest show I ever put on. And it was like a year later for me feeling like I'm going to die. I can't believe I can't do hardcore shows. I have to grow up. And here I am, like, Rich to Life shouting me out, thanks to Joe Hardcore. And I don't care what anybody says. At that time, we had gone and seen 25 to Life in New Jersey, New York, Maryland, you know, everywhere. Like, he was a good person at that stage. So to me, that was like the most rock ignition ever. Until Strength or Unity came out and I was thanked on the record. And I was like, oh my God, 25 to Life, thank me on the record. Craziest shit of my whole life. And like, that's the little things that kept me going. Booking band shows. I mean, I was living on people's couches and sort of staying at my dad's apartment from time to time in the summer of 98 and still doing shows in Junietta at this giant expo center. Like, through my life, hardcore has been like a buoy through the worst, roughest seas I could have. And a lot of them I realized later in hindsight were my own, having no father figure, having just like kind of this rudderless, chaotic life. But hardcore, at the very earliest ages, became the steadiest thing in my life, for better or worse.
And then you talk about, you know what's crazy to hear? For me, it's crazy to hear about you going to shows and there being Nazis there, and you guys, you know, you would go to the show knowing that you're pretty much guaranteed to get into some rowdy brawl.
We went from boots that looked like jack boots because we didn't get them cut off to learning to put weapons in our pants and hide them. And that was like the mid-90s. By 1998, January 98 started off with a friend of ours, Kyle, getting shot outside of the show by a Nazi. We were at a full-on war. Like, this is not self-aggrandizing, you know, but it was real shit. We saw them, we fucked them up. They see us, they might fuck us up. But you gotta remember, I'm 18. People under me later on that got in the hardcore bands, they were 16, 17, but for the dudes that were running, they're 21, 22. The Bad Luck dudes might be 23. But this was our culture in Philadelphia. To the point where the summer of 98, SOD, Fury of Five, and VOD play the truck. The big fight inside. We all go outside. They run to the cars and start shooting at us. So we escalated to gun violence. We escalated to always having knives. And we were about that life at that age. Which wasn't good, because when you intensify that kind of anxiety in a younger, crazy, male-driven culture, we're hyper-violent, hyper-ramped up, and we're ready for anything. In Philadelphia, actually, shows were crazy just because it was not like, oh, worry about this. It was like, no, on site, we're seeing that. But we also had a different skinhead culture. We had Atlantic City skinheads from New Jersey. They had bands, Aggravated Assault, Blue-Eyed Devils. Then you had the Pennsylvania skinheads. You had like, we had actual gang, like it was gang shit. Later on, after American History X came out in like 1999 or something, there was like Pantera white power dudes. We were dealing with straight up punk rock skinhead gang motherfuckers. So we were like, all right, we're gangs, you know, like that's how it came out to be, you know? And what's up? It was always around us. And I mean, I remember being 15. I think there's a picture of me at 15 with like two big X's on my hands. But, you know, the year before, I was drinking 40s in a fucking cemetery. And a year later, when Maria was like, your whole life's over, I was drinking Corona and just thinking my life was over. So like early on, we didn't really, you know, you get exposed to shit you don't really realize. And it was actually, I mentioned earlier, Carmen D'Amico was my first roommate I ever had the first time I moved out at 16. Carmen was the coolest motherfucker. From 1990, I want to say March, or no, Cinco de Mayo 97 until December 3rd, 1999 is a period where I actually was getting fucked up. You know, my whole life was fucked up. And I was like, I literally we're carrying around guns, kitchen knives in our pants. We're getting beat up. We're fighting people. Like, 2 months before the Agnostic Front record release party, or the return of the reunion party before the record release party, me and Carmen got jumped at a Social Distortion H2O show by Nazis. So, like, we're not big dudes. Yeah, I mean, like, you gotta see how skinny I was at that age. So, like, we started, like, really getting into crazy shit. Carmen started dealing drugs. That was, like, my best friend. And in 1999, I had a decent job. I started trying to do this band Punishment because I just got off a U.S. tour. And we were still getting fucked up. And one day, Carmen shot himself. And the surreality of it, I remember that night we got fucked up. I was punching walls. And the next morning, I woke up. I was like, I'm never doing any of this again. And they're like, what do you mean? I'm like, that was the dude that I did everything with. I don't know how to roll a blunt. I actually, my dad put my hand over a fire because I touched a match when I was a kid. I hate even using lighters. You know, like, I never smoked a cigarette in my life. Smoked a lot of weed, smoked some dust, and drank cough syrup, cheap cough syrup in 40s. Then we get fucked up and walk around fucked up. So I literally just said that day, boom, never doing this ever again. It was like, yeah, whatever. And that was 21 years ago this year.
Yeah, that's insane because a lot of people, when they go through a dramatic experience like that, like the common person, they actually go the opposite way. They fall onto drugs and alcohol as a way to escape reality, you know, to stop thinking about those things. For you to say, like, you stop doing that, it's like, it's fucking, like, inspiring. Like, it's
Well, I was, like, 16. Yeah, I remember. I was 16 years old. Gonna
Especially
be a dad.
At 16.
That's when I was, like, I would say, like, we were straight edge, but... What can a 16-year-old kid who can't get served be straight edge? You know, like,
yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? So, like, and so, you know what, fuck it. I'm just going to get fucked up all the time. And that was, like, a crazy, weird entire time. The summer of 98, I hit my mother, got kicked out of the house, had to go down to my dad's house, which is, like, the worst experience you could possibly have at that time. And I don't even want to be at his house, so I'm sleeping on people's couches, sleeping outside in parks with my homeboys. We're drinking till 3 in the morning. Mind you, I have a daughter that's 1 going on 2. I'm seeing her on the weekends at her mother's house. And so, yeah, I was pretty much what you said about, like, falling into. I had my falling into period, and the threshold came because my main dude, Carmen, shot himself, and it broke my heart. And it was like, I just that summer toured in the U.S. I drank a 40 with my dead friend now, Ernie Powerhouse, in Oakland, California. I didn't drink that entire tour. Literally didn't drink that entire tour because I was with Dysphoria. We did a whole U.S. tour. I just turned 19. And again, we talk about hardcore and the buoy. Like, I'm on tour. I don't need to get fucked up. Like, getting fucked up was the escape. And when Carmen died, that was it. It was over. I didn't want to do that no more. And that was the turning point. And I think things got a little bit better. I mean, but yeah, I would say because of how I looked at my life and how I felt like I lost, I scored a 1375 on PSATs. I was smart, but I got into a lot of fights as a kid, so I couldn't go to certain schools. I was an asshole mentality because I was super angry. I didn't have the kind of platform of support because my mother had to work. She did the best that she physically could. You know, we didn't. I had a very large chip on my shoulder for a very long time in my life, and weed just made me fall asleep. Dust made me ride around in a spray painted gold girl's bike all hours of the night, and yeah, like it just all kind of fell apart as hardcore. Like that, like shining moment of going on my first U.S. tour, kind of was like the voice. Like, you need to do a band. You need to go on tour. You need to stay away from Philadelphia. Because all my friends from that first area I was telling you about, where we were kicking out L windows, them dudes were all growing up. Them dudes were all going to college. And what am I doing? We're going to shows, getting into fights, hitting people with fucking everything under the sun. You know, that summer I carried the cheapest gun on me ever, like a little 25, 2 kitchen knives, and like literally was just out for fucking chaos. And God bless that I never got really in trouble. Because I could have did just 10 years and got caught with that shit.
Yeah, 100%. I was just thinking about that.
Just got lucky. And we, like, I also, because I was a weird headbanger, I could climb like a motherfucker. I stopped being able to run really fast, but I could literally climb. I wasn't good at getting down, which I broke my wrist and hand a lot as a kid. But I could climb the shit out of a fence and a wall. So shit would go down. We'd run, hide. Like, it was very good and elusive.
Speaking of breaking your hand, I saw on the BJJ United page that you broke your hand and then you kept training even though it was broken, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how we could see it, but this pinky has a hammer pinky. I broke it one time.
Yeah, that looks pretty broken.
And he said it was broken. It's actually a ripped tendon.
Okay.
I got my first construction job at 1998 with these off the boat Irish, which is another huge part of why I stayed drinking, was that I got on the first day of working. We get in the truck afterwards, like, look at here, buddy. The only thing you don't drink on the truck is the tools. What? The only thing you don't drink on the truck is the tools. You don't drink, you sit in the back with the tools. Here's a beer. You earned it. And so I'm like, oh, I guess I'm drinking with Irish guys. And I learned to mix stucco, learned to mix cement. And so, like, I have already onset arthritis. I have carpal tunnel from troweling and chipping concrete and grinding shit. So I've been breaking my hands since I was a kid getting into fights, you know, like the boxer breaks. And so Bob from FYA is like my protege. Everything that I try to teach somebody about booking, I put into him. He does this awesome festival. For years, I'd be like, yo, I'd love to come down, but we're about to be out of work. I don't work in January a lot because of winter, so I don't have the kind of money. I'm not a baller. I don't ball off of hardcore. So it's, oh, spend a couple $100 when you know you're not going to make money for a while, or go down to a hardcore fest. So this year, Bob bought me a plane ticket so I go down to Florida. The very first fucking night, the first band I mosh for, Death Before Dishonor, sends a shout out to me, and I hit a pole and break my fucking hand.
They have that pole there at FYA.
Yeah, I literally, not at FYA, because they moved to a bigger venue. It was like a big hall, but the pre-show, they had a pole in this small venue, and I broke my fucking hand. I mean, that night I was out at 2 in the morning at the goth club. Like, I didn't let anything stop me, because you break your hand, you're wrapping ice, whatever, it gets better. So I came back, and I started training. And Jared's like, what'd you do to your hand? I'm like, I punched the pole. He's like, what do you mean? I'm like, moshing. He's like, all right, no big deal. You all good with it? I'm good with it. And my wife, because she's a wife, is like, please get it looked at. I'm like, nah, it's okay. And I was back to pouring concrete and setting concrete. And I was like, would hammer a concrete pin. I'm like, oh, shit, this actually hurts. So I go in 2 weeks after I get back from FYA, and my bone is literally snapped. And they're like, you need to have surgery. And I'm like, when? They're like, how about Tuesday? I'm like, I'm pouring concrete Tuesday. He's like, what do you mean you poured concrete? You're working right now? I'm like, yeah, I've been pouring concrete. And he's like, okay, well, how about Thursday? I'm like, cool, I get to go to jiu-jitsu Wednesday night. He's like, you're doing jiu-jitsu? And he like was so aggravated that I was still using my hand. And then I showed Jarrett, and he's like, what the fuck is wrong with you? But you got, like, as a kid, I broke my arm, my ankles. My mom actually, they were worried. My mom was abusing me. Like I said, I climbed a lot of shit. I climbed trees, climbed fences, stitches. Like, I was a very hyperactive kid. So I got hurt a lot. I have a crazy pain threshold. You know, like fucking at a roadhouse. Pain don't hurt. Like, we didn't have a car. I broke my ankle. My mom just like, all right, we got to kind of like hold my shoulder. We had to like limp to get there. I broke my arm. We had to walk 2 miles at a hospital. You know what I mean? Like, luckily we lived. Eventually we lived next door to my uncle. We literally lived a block from the hospital. But, like, before that, yo, I broke my arm one time, and I came home. My mom's like, your arm's broke. Oh, really? Yeah, look at it. You know, they had to re-break it right there. Like, early on, I broke a lot of shit. You know, I broke my nose at 12 years old. It's been broken probably 10 times now. Had surgery twice. Re-broke it right after surgery. Like, I'm stupid.
But, yo, that's insane. And now you're into jiu-jitsu. So, how'd that come about?
So,
How did you first get into jiu-jitsu?
What's that?
How'd you first get into jiu-jitsu?
Getting into was hanging out with the Headbangers and being at Blockbuster and seeing this UFC VHS and taking it home and being like, this is the craziest shit on earth. Which then we then watched pay-per-view the next time it came on, which is UFC 2. Juxtapose this with going to hardcore shows, one young Jared Wiener being at the shows in the pit and someone being like, yo, that dude trains jiu-jitsu. And we're like, oh shit, he's Hoist Gracie. So like, Jarrett years ago, Jarrett's my old head in hardcore. Years ago, outside the Trocadero, I'm like, yo, let me see some jiu-jitsu. He's like, come at me. I'm like, okay. And he straight up hit tossed me on a concrete, gave me a concussion. He's like, yo, I felt so bad, man. You're my young boy. But like, so we knew it existed, but I don't got the money for jiu-jitsu. I didn't even think like I could do jiu-jitsu. And I had a lot of friends from the 90s hardcore scene, 2000s hardcore scene, who got very involved in jiu-jitsu. And I done American Kempo as a kid. We all got taught how to box. But, you know, it never thought to me that I could do jiu-jitsu. And fast forward to my late 30s, I'm married. I'm working at an oil refinery running a job. I'm getting fat because I'm the boss of the job. I have like 2 45-minute lunches. I got a 3-hour commute. I gained a lot of fucking weight. And I'm outside of the I'm inside a show, and H2O Adam, I told this story on the Instagram, but we did a show at the basement of the church, obviously, and Adam's like, there's a guy outside with a baseball bat and a hoodie. I was kind of like, oh, all right. And, you know, I had a lot of friends at the show, so I'm like, oh, we'll go out and check it out. It was the end of the show. We have to sweep, clean, mop the floors before we can leave the venue. That's what's so cool about the church. We get a hall, we turn it into a mess, and then we have to get rid of the mess and return it. It's actually like a ritual sake. Like, you get to use this place, but you have to take care of it. And it, like, infused a lot of cool shit. So I realized at some point, all right, I don't hear no one getting killed, so maybe everything's good. So I go up the steps of the church, and as soon as I go outside, I hear, yo, motherfucker, and this guy comes at me with a baseball bat. And I told my dudes, hey, stand back. I'm like, yo, chill out, man, you got rax. So then I go in the trash, and I threw a bottle at him, missed, threw another bottle, hit him in the face, and ran and grabbed him around his chest and picked him up and slammed him on the ground. Now, obviously, because I'm kind of a fucking retard goon, I had worked the door at the bars. I got taught how to, like, safely take people to the ground and that kind of stuff from, like, bar bouncer training that they give you, you know? But, like, I was a door guy most of the time, you know? Like, so I knew enough to take people out of shows. So I knew how to pick somebody up and slam them on the ground. There, after that whole situation was disposed of, Adam and Toby were like, Jared has to give you an honorary belt for that. That was great street jiu-jitsu. And there was a guy from BJJ United who was there. Who I was like, yo, what do you think? He's like, no, that was exactly what you should do in jiu-jitsu. And now I understand it. I basically ran up, got under hooks, literally slammed him, and stayed in full mount. I didn't pummel him. I told him, like, dude, I love you. You got to calm down. You know, I had to hit him a couple of times. I'm like, yo, chill out. But I just maintained mount and was like, yo, you need to chill the fuck out. And it definitely threw me through a loop because I might get into, like, some stupid shit, but I haven't been in real back-and-forth fights in a while. I've kind of not grown past it, but socially, I don't put myself in them positions often. So I was like, man, are we at this stage where young kids only want to throw hands? They just want to hit you with a bat? And then I'm like, are they that afraid of me? Because, like, old shit? Like, what the fuck? And I texted Jared. He's like, dude, heard you're doing some jiu-jitsu down there, like, fucking with me. I talked to him about it, and he's like, dude, I think you should try it. He's like, it doesn't hurt you to learn, and it could, you know, obviously look at the situation. You're still in the mix with all this crazy shit. My wife went behind my back and bought a gi from the school, and I got bad concrete burn on my knee the week I was going to start. Like, when you get concrete burn, it looks like the worst scab you've ever had, but it's wet. Like a wet healing scab on my knee. So when we did the Wisdom and Chains Already Dead video, there's a bunch of dudes in jiu-jitsu, and Jared's like, what? Are you ever going to train? Your wife bought that gi a month ago. I'm like, look at my knee. He's like, don't put that knee on my mat. But when that knee heals, you better get your ass on the mat. And that's really what got me to take the leap into jiu-jitsu.
That's probably the best thing I've heard all month. And I'm so that just made my day.
It's like, it literally was like, literally like a lightning striking at the perfect time. Like, I was depressed. I've dealt with depression and suicidal tendencies for most of my life. I didn't have that outlet anymore from that rush. Like, yeah, I can mosh and kick somebody. There are some times where you're like, I start moshing, people stop moshing. I'm like, all right, maybe I'm either too crazy or maybe it's just not the time for me. Like, I don't get that play like the younger kids get to play anymore, you know? Like, stage dives hurt when you land bad, you know? Plus, I facilitate a lot of these shows, so I don't have that same mosh for five bands energy expelled, you know? And I pour concrete for a living, but that's like, this is what you do to make money. This is how you feed your family. This isn't like, I feel so great, I just straight-edged all this concrete. This is like, oh, this is what you had to do for a living. So you don't get that cathartic release physically. So jiu-jitsu just gave me that.
How was your first time rolling?
So, I was never concerned about it, to be, like, honest, because I was just heavy. I was, like, a fat person. And I hadn't been fat my whole life, but I was, like, in the 260s, almost 270. And jiu-jitsu's fucked up because we don't, Jarrett's doesn't have like a step. You don't just show up on your first day and they reset the jiu-jitsu clock that this is class one. You show up and that day it's whatever they teach you. And you're like, ah. So I'm like, this guy's got his coat wrapped around my neck. I don't really understand it, but I like the teaching atmosphere of BJJ United. I like the team aspect of it. So the first time I go, they're here, don't roll, but watch. And I kind of saw it. I was like, I don't really understand what's going on, but fuck it, I'll try it. So then my first time rolling, I was just fat and out of weight, like out of shape, but I was heavy and tall. So if I could get on top of the guy, I would just squeeze, like overhook, underhook, and just like, so I got swept a lot. And then I had a lot of shoulders in my face. And we're old school pressure passing. So immediately someone's whole shoulder in my face. And I'm like, I don't really like this, but I know how to get out of it. And instead of being like, oh, I didn't do good, I realized like, yeah, I fucking suck at this. And the first month, I started at the end of June 2018. I was on a vacation with my wife in Maine in August of 2018. And Hard Carl, who's like a legendary hardcore dude, owns a tattoo shop in DC, builds tattoo machines, like an old school fucking hardcore dude who we grew up with, moved back to Philly.
Yeah, he trains at BJJ United as well, right?
Yeah, he started training. So I'm in Maine, and I see a picture of Carl's first class, and I'm like, fuck yeah, Carl! Yeah! Like, I have a... like, and that was it. I had, like, Carl is like my life partner now. Carl is like my best, closest friend. I literally, like, he trains Monday mornings at 11:30 a.m. I'll be at work. He'll text me, class was brutal. Here's who I rolled with. This is a technique. And then I go to Tuesday night classes, and I'll be like, yo, here's what we did. And then we would meet together on Thursday night, a half an hour before class, and he's like, this is what they showed me. Then I would show him what I learned. And we would pair up on Thursdays. And, like, having that, I mean, he's 10 years older than me, but he's about the same size. He's a little bit taller. Same thing, heavy as shit, out of shape, old hardcore dude, mentally not all there, but just like needs something. And that was like a drive. I had like a, oh yeah, well, we're also tattooed fucking goon maniacs. And that was really, with, you know, you gotta figure within 6 weeks of starting, I had like a partner like that, you know, that I could go through all this with.
Since you started training jiu-jitsu, have you noticed like a change in your like mental state? Like, you're talking about growing up like having suicidal tendencies, being so aggressive. Like, do you see that like peaceful side to jiu-jitsu being like this warrior in a garden like type of deal?
It's heavenly. It's literally it was the balance that I always needed and never saw there. At a show, I'll leave it at a show because there's like two of these moments. Where, like, some kid was getting way too crazy, and I'm at one point, he's like ripping my shirt. I didn't hit him. And I kick, like front sweep his leg. And I go knee on belly, and I'm like, please let go of my shirt. And everyone's like, I'm like, don't hit him. Just let go of my shirt, please. And the bouncers took him away, and I was like, dude, you all right? I'm like, yeah. Why? Because I knew he wasn't going to punch me. I had his arms, I had my knee on his stomach. That sucked for him. Like, jiu-jitsu gives you that normalized piece of, oh, you want to struggle? Cool. I do this for fun. So, where are we at now? Let's do this. You know, like, I need an outlet. I need a mental outlet. I need a physical outlet. I need to be challenged. And I hadn't been challenged with, like, you need to get better. And you know, so back to the breaking the hand. I break my hand. I'm worried, you know, oh, it's, you know, this is a slow season for work anyway. So I'm like, ah, that'll be what it is. I was like, Jarrett, can I please train? He's like, you cannot live roll, but you can take any class. You just, I don't want to see you fucking rolling. So I don't have work. I was in jiu-jitsu every single day that a hand was broken. Any class I could physically get to, Monday morning, sometimes Monday morning, Monday night, if my wife wasn't home, or Monday morning, sometimes Monday morning, Tuesday night, Wednesday morning, like Thursday night, like anything I could go and do just to stay immersed. I have a book, write down the technique, and then because my hand's broke, I'm typing the technique, put left hand here.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like, I know that if I was exposed to jiu-jitsu at the time when Jarrett and I went, the part of me that sought violence would have been found because of Jarrett's school being Maxwell and the fact that they were still doing Gracie challenges and they're still striking. I probably would have benefited at that point. But it wouldn't have been the saving grace in my late 30s like I needed it to be. I wasn't happy. I haven't been, like, there's existential happiness. Why are we breathing air? What's the purpose to all this? And dude, I have a cool dog. I have a beautiful wife. I have a job that lets me make money, so I don't have to depend on hardcore shows to be my reason how I eat and put a roof over our heads. And yet there's still like an emptiness that just is always going to be there. And I don't have that problem. You know, it's Monday. I had too much shit to do. I didn't get to go to class tonight, which is Monday's like, it doesn't matter. There is no missing Tuesday class. Like, I'll miss a show or be late to a show than not miss Tuesday class. Like, I have, like, rules in jiu-jitsu. Like, you know, like, I try to not book shows on Tuesdays and Thursday nights just so I don't have to, like, oh, I don't know. I don't want to miss class.
Yeah, yeah.
That's where I'm at in my life.
It definitely becomes, like, an obsession and a passion and something that just really brightens up your life in a way that's, as weird as it is to say to anyone who doesn't train, it's, like, undescribable how much it elevates your life.
Boy, because there's a kinetic energy that comes from the physical movement with a person. And once you're inoculated to how a human being feels, like if they're in your side mount and their shoulder's in your face, it's aggressive, but there's a physical bond. We agreed upon that you will put your shoulder in your face if you need to, and I need to get out of it. And it presents you with an option. How do I get him off me? Do I grab his pant leg and try to go to a half guard? Do I think I'm strong enough to, you know, like, it's a puzzle and it's an agreement between two people that, hey, we have enough respect for each other that we're going to exude violence, but we're not going to take it to a burning threshold point where we have to go to fists. So it's a hard game. Saturday, a really cool dude named Majed from our school who literally has this much of an arm. This is where his stump ends. He had a weird takedown. We both landed odd. I landed on my head, sort of, because I couldn't break fall. He lands on me, and he's got his weight on me. He's like, dude, are you good? I'm like, a little starry, but yeah. He's like, yeah, man, that kind of hurt. I'm like, let's do it, though. And he's in side control, but like, where else when you're doing this shit do you both fall, and then someone's like, hey, are you cool?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I'm going to go back to hurting you now.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
What? What the fuck are we like? You know, like, there's a surreality that. It also ended me with trying to armbar that stump, which I will tell you, I don't know how you armbar a stump.
There's you tried to armbar the stump.
Yeah, that's how we. I like armbars are easy for me to get. I transition them well, and he stuck it out, and I'm like, fuck it. Stepped over, put the thing, squeezed my legs. I'm going trying to like get the stump. Like I cannot do this. And he's like, dude, and he goes, if I had an arm, man, totally would have tapped. Like you don't get that in any other environment, man. Like you don't get. And our school, obviously, is very old-school pressure passing. If you've never been to BJJ United, I have a lot of friends because of jiu-jitsu that are from hardcore. And I have a lot of friends that – one of the guys in my that I grew up with, three blocks away, was in a band with him later who played in a band horror show. And we did one show as a band called The Crossbearer. He's a black belt under 10th Planet, and he runs the Ventura. He owns 10th Planet Ventura. He moved to California in the 2000s. And started his life over. And he's a fucking 10th Planet black belt. The girl who videotaped all the shows from like 98, 99, 2000, Jamila, moved to California. She's a brown belt under, I can't say her name right, Leah Vera. She's the highest degree female black belt in the world. She's a brown belt. She's competed at Fight to Win. Like, I have friends from the 90s that are getting back into it. It's like, I can't believe you guys are doing jiu-jitsu. Maybe I need to get back to it. And that was the other thing is when we were touring, you talk to a guy doing jiu-jitsu and he'd be like, yeah, I toured my ACL. And I'm like, if I do that, I don't have work. Like, you know, like there was a deterrent when hardcore people started doing it. All I'm hearing is elbows getting pulled out. And I'm like, yeah, that means I can't make money. You know, I toured with bands. I came home and I either got a job building shit, making shit. And then later when I got into the union, it was just concrete work. So there is no, oh yeah, this guy tore my, I gotta get my shoulder re. Like, no, that means I can't work. So that was a huge deterrent with my friendships. Matt Pike, who's a booking agent. Rich Thurston, who's in a ton of straight edge bands. The list goes on and on of hardcore dudes who in the early 2000s were doing jiu-jitsu and getting hurt. Which now I know, understand culturally because the Gracie schools were like, yeah, kill, get. And there wasn't that, we need to protect these people. It was like, fuck it, who cares if they get their arms smashed. You know what I mean? So, like, hardcore still supplements a lot of my social interactions and a lot of the mind work of booking shows and the busybody of being on phones, getting bands. But jiu-jitsu is the, like, my silent personal, like, journey. Like, you know, like, me and Carl got our blue belts together, and we had coffee afterwards, and he's like, what do you think? I said, we've got at least 1,000 days of getting our ass kicked. He's like, you think 1,000? I'm like, maybe more. I just think it's going to be at least 1,000. That's what in my head. You know, like, it's a silent thing. And you don't worry if a guy, oh, this guy got his blue belt, and, you know, he's better than me. Yeah, look out. He's fucking 10 years younger, 15 years younger. He's fucking ripped. You know, like, it's, our team is so fucking great that you come to BJJ United, which is the point I was getting back to, you got to start class together. You bow in, you line up, belt order, all right, boom, starting class. End of class, you line up, tie your belts, and there's this quiet, we don't really roll to music. There's a quiet sense of hearing the entire class panting. Even the black belts. And everyone's tying their belts like, I realized that early on rolling. I'm not the only person out of breath. I'm not the only person tired. I'm not the only person who's looking for the energy to tie your fucking belt. And then, like, there's no water bottles on the mat and deciding not to. I don't even know what would happen if someone's like, I'm just tired. I'm not rolling this round. I've never seen it at our school. I don't even understand what would happen. Like, my whole head would explode. It's just accepted that you are going to roll because it is time to roll. Pick a partner. If you're tired, you better get on top. You better get a good-ass defense game. That's my game right now is, this guy's going to take me down. This is going to suck. Maybe I'll get better with escapes. Remember underhooks. I'm really bad with remembering underhooks.
Yeah. One of my coaches, Luis Cabrera, he has actually a website and a saying. He always says, beware the underhook.
I'm not a wrestler. In fact, I learning that wrestlers were so strong, we were soccer dudes. We made fun of wrestlers. You ever see that scene in Billy Madison where Billy Madison writes the guy who would eventually shoot the guy who was going to kill him? Sorry for everything I did and give him a phone call.
Yep.
I want to do that to every wrestler me made fight of in high school because they're kings. They're already, they have, like, I did not know that that is what I should have did instead of playing soccer in high school. You know, because although this area and obviously in New York, wrestling is a big thing. So a lot of these guys coming in are wrestlers. They're just innate to destroy you. And I'm like, so I have to learn, oh shit, remember this underhook, you know? Jiu-jitsu is an experience for me that, you know, I could have rested on my laurels and be like, back in my day, we kicked people's asses. I now look at one of our best coaches is a dude named Lobster. We're like, if Jared's still on the podcast talking to JT Torres, that dude's getting shouted out. He doesn't compete. He's one of the best teachers we have, and he's a fucking problem. He's super dangerous. He's actually the most painful person in the, like, unilaterally, Jared will be like, he's probably the most dangerous person to roll with, and he's the most nice person. Jiu-jitsu taught me that when I was young, I'm like, oh, this guy looks like a pussy. There is no person looking like a pussy on a street that you should actively seek violence with because you really don't know if they're a purple belt or a brown belt or black belt and will fucking break your wrist. It's a lot of things, man. It's a lot of things. And then you then take this jiu-jitsu culture, you put it on top of hardcore, and you got the internet. Now you have people that I have, you know, I'm getting old now. I'm not cool on Twitter, man. You know, like, I don't want to be on Facebook arguing about shit, so I'm on the Twitter and Instagram. And now I've got young hardcore kids like, yo, how'd you start jiu-jitsu? Or like, dude's like, dude, I can't believe you trained. You know, like, it's a new thing to keep me excited about both hardcore and jiu-jitsu.
Yeah.
Go.
No, I think, because we've had a few jiu-jitsu guests from Bronx Jiu-Jitsu from his gym. And a lot of what they've had in common, what a lot of them brought up was, like, they used to fight so much outside, but since they've started training jiu-jitsu, they don't even look for fights no more. Like, they've come to the point where they have this confidence. Not like a cocky confidence, but they know their ability and they know there's no point in showing it to anybody. Like, they know what they can do compared to a regular person outside, you know? So,
well, that's the struggle of ego and pride in a young man is, like, in this social interaction, in a social incident, I have to stay on top. I have to be the person that wins. And there really is no winning if this guy pulls out a gun and shoots you. And I started grasping that as things became more honest and real. Like, my wife, I met her while I was on tour as a younger. She moved to California. I am a father. My kids are older. They don't live with me. But, like, if I get hurt, she, what is she going to do? You know? And then also, like, cool, I can roll around in the street and fight with this idiot. You know, like, I learned from bouncing at clubs what was worth it, what wasn't. And not that the fight isn't in me anymore, but in jiu-jitsu, I just look at, you can look at the situation from a different angle. Like, oh, this guy's getting aggressive. Well, I need to watch what he's up to. Because before, I was like, in a Jocko's term, default aggression. If you're going to get violent, I'll wait. I'm not going to wait for you to hit me. I might as well just hit you and let's just have this fight. You know, like, but that's the goon shit. As you get into jiu-jitsu, you realize, like, I don't need to do all this. Like, you know, oh, you're mad at me? Like, I don't get upset half of the time because I'm like, oh, man, that guy really has a hard life that he's upset with somebody over something, like, whether it's in a store, a rude gesture, or driving. Like, fuck you. I was never a guy who would pull over, you know? But, like, jiu-jitsu taught me that any person on the street has a better chance of fucking me up than I realize. And also, why expose myself to that level of potential violence? Because, dude, I never rolled around the ground. I might eye poke you. I was a very dirty fighter. Fish hooks, eye pokes, no problem. Headbutts, which is why I got scars on my head. Look at how beautiful my fucking nose is. That's why I'm getting my teeth redone, because I had them so loose from fighting. You should seek to not want to be a fighter, you know? And the hardest dudes in jiu-jitsu are the least likely to be fighters, you know? And you can see it in a lot of that. And it's kind of cool. It's a peaceful thing. We don't have shit talking. I know your school's like that too. There's no shit talking. We don't say when we're getting our gis off, yo, did you see me? I tapped that guy out. You don't talk like that. It's just that one moment where you did something that person didn't do. There's a humility and there's a pecking order. Saturday, I went to Jared's class. It's the first time since COVID started. I go against a hard blue belt who made me eat shit and tap me like 6 times in 6 minutes. And the best thing I can do when someone taps me is stand back up and be like, all right, let's go again. And try to not look like I was tired. Like, all right, fuck you. Let's do it again. Did that 2 rounds of 2 separate dudes smashing me. And then I roll with this dude who's a white belt. And I did that to him. And I'm like, see, this is the pecking order. Like, you know, I get him. I get got. There's a beautiful cycle of it, you know. And I appreciate jiu-jitsu for teaching humility and teaching you to better yourself. And it's like, cool, I get in this fight. I'm going to get arrested. You know. Jarrett being a police officer, be like, why did you get into a fight in the street? What are you being dumb for? You know, like, you want to hold yourself to a higher expectation. Plus, as I learned with hip breaking my hand, cool, less time rolling. You know, I didn't have a live roll, like a hard live roll, all of 2000. Actually, there was like 2 classes I hit the week when my hand got better and cleared. So I had 2 classes where I had maybe 4 rolls each class, and then it was COVID. So until COVID, you know, I had 8 rolls, like actual full speed, hey, don't watch my hand kind of deal. So, like, I'm 8 months behind. My timing is still off, you know? Like, I can't jeopardize that by getting a fight with some dude who's mad at me. Yeah, cool, be mad at me. Fuck off.
I'm hoping that whenever things clear up or whatever, because I know that people at the Bronx Jiu-Jitsu are planning on going over to BJJ United for a day or whatever. So, I'm hoping that when I go, I can meet you in person and we can roll or whatever.
We love that.
I would love that. I would.
You look small. You look small and like someone who's going to get out from under me and smash me. So I look forward to being slow.
I can try my best, man. But what do you say to the people who are thinking about trying it but are like kind of on the fence?
I tell everybody the same thing. It's a trust fall. You either show up and act like a bitch and be like, I don't think this is for me. The stress thing, ready? So it's stress, like, oh, I'm not doing jiu-jitsu. And I get behind him, and I put him in a rear naked choke. He's like, what the fuck, man? And he's like, he'll say it didn't happen, but this is the real truth. It's in Maryland. His BAM Activate played, and Shattered Realm was going to play. And he's like, I'll just get my gun. I go, you get your gun ready. We're going to go at the same time. I'll choke you before you can get your gun and shoot. Like, you know, so we get in. I have my hooks in. I have my overhook. I'm ready to go. He's like, dude, fuck this. I got to start going. Like, more and more we inoculate, not through that means, but we tell our friends, like, this is why we're doing it. Come hang out. Hard Carl's lost 60 pounds. I've lost 60 pounds. Big Black Dennis from Bad Luck. That motherfucker is trying to get down to 290 just so he can come back to rolling. We had to buy him like a 6X gi so we could start it. Like, this is the path to better physical health, better mental health. But on top of it, what do you get to lose? Somebody guy lays all over top of you? You know, like, I tell everybody, you got to just try it. And I've had friends that come, they do the checkout class, and they roll, and they go, I don't know, man. This is crazy. I don't know. How do you do this after work? I don't care. I'd rather be tired. You know? I believe in naps. I come over and work 2, 3 o'clock. I nap. I stretch. I get ready for jiu-jitsu, and I fucking go. I don't care if I'm tired afterwards. I would rather be tired and barely walking. Then I tell them, the worst 2 days of your life is the first 2 days you go to jiu-jitsu. And as long as you stop eating like a fat fuck, it gets easier.
Yeah, I actually, during quarantine, I had my friend, we got Walmart mats, like the puzzle mats. We duct taped them because they kept coming apart. And I had like my friend start training with me. He ended up, well, we trained a lot during the quarantine, just in my garage, just me and him. We had like my computer set up. We'd play like King Nine and like a bunch of bands and just roll. And then I showed him, like, he didn't know, like, he knew nothing, right? So then I showed him, like, everything well, that I could in the meantime that I knew. And then now he actually trains at Bronx Jiu-Jitsu. He goes twice a day, every day that he can go, and he loves it.
Yeah. That's the important thing is it gives you a chance to expose people to what you've been exposed to, and you're paying it forward, you know? Like, with Jordan, with his True Path thing, like, I mean, Jordan's always been an aggressive, smart person, very active, and then you know, I start doing jiu-jitsu, and people are like, yo, you know Jordan does jiu-jitsu? You know this person does jiu-jitsu? And you start looking at all these different people. DFJ, who played drums in Rival Mob, he plays in all these different bands. The motherfucker's a black belt in jiu-jitsu and owns his own jiu-jitsu school now. I was on the phone with him. I just called him. I was like, you do jiu-jitsu? He's like, fuck yeah, I do. Yo, man, think about... He's like, yo, I think about opening up my own school, man. You gotta come up and train. I'm like, what? Like, you know, like, there's all these paths that lead back to hardcore. You know, Gian from King Nine trains with Con Gracie.
I did not know this. You're blowing my mind right now.
Yeah.
I knew, like the dude from Biohazard trained, like, you trained, like, but I didn't know.
Yeah, yeah. Jotham from Wisdom of Chains is a purple belt. Billy from Biohazard is a black belt. Dude, there's Roger from Agnostic Front. His wife is a jiu-jitsu, Gracie jiu-jitsu instructor. He trains. Gavin from Burn. There's so many people that train in jiu-jitsu, and it's because that kind of stuff is relevant to people like us. In our school, there's like a dude, he literally, Dave, he shows up and he'll wear like a throwdown hoodie or like a Hatebreed hoodie, and we're like, damn, sick shirt. We go, what's up? But he just had a kid, so he hasn't been coming in. But Brandon, he's a young wrestler who's more from the Christian hardcore side of things. He'll be like, dude, so what's up with the fest? Yo, do you think we'll get this band? There's a band from here called Dark Day Dawning. The singer is a purple belt. He's super good. There's a white belt dude who ran the first website message board at our school. All these people, we all came together at jiu-jitsu. We started looking, oh, shit, what are you doing here? Oh, you know, like, next thing you know, you're finding all these people through hardcore that are also involved in jiu-jitsu. And it goes on and on. There's tons of hardcore people. True Believer is a school in Pittsburgh. not only Jake... True Believer, Mosh is hard as shit, and he's a black belt. Jamie from Code Orange, Justin from Code Orange. I think everybody but one person in Code Orange train.
What?
In fact, I think Jamie is not far from getting his brown belt.
What?
Goldman's a blue belt. Jamie's a black belt, or a purple belt. Jamie actually fucked up Hard Carl in Philly. I'll talk shit on Hard Carl for fighting an armbar for 2 minutes instead of just tapping and resetting. And Jarrett told his coach, yo, man, he's looking good, and Jamie got a purple belt. You know, like... There's people all over training and are excited. Josh White from Florida, he trains with Gracie Tampa. He just got on a competition team. Like, there's tons of people that get involved with this. You know, the thing is I think that as a hardcore culture, everyone's in their own gyms. And unless you post something on Instagram, you don't know. But, yeah, it's alive and well. Oh, the dudes from Bulldoze, Mike, the purveyor of the greatest rips of all time. Mike's a blue belt in jiu-jitsu. McGee, I think he's a purple belt.
This is crazy.
Yeah, like, oh yeah, the singer of Agent of Man, he's a purple belt. Yeah, he came to this hardcore. I'm like, yeah, you stopped at purple. He's like, yeah, I've been training in 3 years. I'm like, you stopped after purple? Like, it blew my mind. My boy George.
Everyone got to watch out when they go to this hardcore. They're surrounded by jiu-jitsu specialists.
Mike Wilson, who runs Gorilla Jiu-Jitsu in North Jersey, is like, yo, you got to do this as jiu-jitsu.
I follow their account, too. I love their gym. It looks really cool. They're part of the tag team thing, too.
Yeah. Mike Wilson trained under Henzo and eventually got his black belt under Jarrett. They're out in Mahwah, which is like the left corner of New Jersey. We were there for the school opening. And yeah, that's the thing is like, I like that now. I'm like, yo, man, we should travel up to Manchester, New Hampshire to train in heavy metal jiu-jitsu. Like, you know, like, yo, I'm in St. Louis. Actually, fucked up. I break my hand Friday night. Thursday night. I was supposed to train Friday morning at the Gracie School. And I packed a fucking gi and no gi shit. So I got like two pairs of like clothes and all my jiu-jitsu shit with me. I couldn't even fucking train because I broke my hand. I was so bummed. You know, like, so my luggage was 90 jiu-jitsu, 10% clothes. You know, like, that's what it does to you.
100%. 100%. Yo, so it's been an hour and 20. So I just want to say thank you so much for this. I enjoyed it more than you know. I'm going to re-listen to this a few times because I just loved this conversation. Tell people about, real quick, before we end this, your like podcast that you're doing and stuff like that.
So we are currently in the beginning stages of recording. I'm really weird about this. I was a little pensive about even doing one. I don't like being a – I am that fucking punk rock dude. Oh, everybody's doing it. I don't want to do it. But I like being on podcasts, and I have a lot of friends who do cool ones. But then – and I'll be honest, I don't want to do a podcast where I go, hey, Scott Vogel, what's up with the new record? I don't want to listen to that. That doesn't dry – like, I listen to weird podcasts, obviously the JREs, the Jockos, but I also listen to Lex Fridman's Artificial Intelligence. Like, I listen to a lot of Audible books. I listen while I work because a lot of times I'm by myself. You know, so I want to hear a story about someone's life. I don't really care what their next t-shirt's coming out. So one of the guests who will be in the first episodes, we were talking about, what are you going to name it? I'm like, I have no idea. And he's like, I would brand it under This Is Hardcore just because you've got a solid social media. And I mean, obviously, look at my track record. My festival, This Is Hardcore. My show bookings, Philly Hardcore Shows and Joe Hardcore Presents. I'm super creative when it comes to naming shit. So we're gonna do, I have three more to record in the next week. We're going to lay out, get it all set up. So that way when we start loading them, we're going to do load two. And then we'll be able to release weekly and kind of see what's going to happen with it. But the thread that we've gone with is talking to people who have learned things that are DIY and either impose them in their daily life, in their careers that are not involved in hardcore, or, hey, this is how I learned to do this, and this is why I'm very good and why I'm still doing what I'm doing in hardcore because this is what I did. And we're not talking about online shit. We're talking about how, like, for me, when I was a promoter, as a kid, I hand wrote letters to bands. I have letters from Jamie Hapriot. I have letters from Scott Vogel. Hand wrote, I would like to book your band. Shit don't happen no more. We're like in the dark ages. And I want hardcore kids now to be inspired who feel, like, always, you see this word gatekeeping thrown around by these young kids. It's like, we had to physically do everything by hand. We had to do this harder than you guys have to. You have the internet. You're attached to every human being involved in hardcore. How quick did I respond to you when you wrote me? How quick did we set this up? We have the assets, the information, and the will, or the will, but these kids don't have the information. Like, oh, I can actually learn how to do this because of podcasting. That in my 2 weeks since I bought the shit and got everything start rolling, I started learning how to mess with the audio more and do these things because I usually get somebody to help me, like, hey, you want to help me? Cool. Okay, I'm just going to do this part. You have to do all the technical stuff, and I don't want to even ask you. Just do it. And then I don't learn how to do it, and then I'm dependent. If somebody can't do something, it's not the way to do this. So with this is my own task of doing this more of myself, which is why I have this setup because I'm trying to get used to doing this. But This Is Hardcore theme podcast. It's going to be named This Is Hardcore Podcast. And at least the first 10 guests, because we've got them all lined up, and I've just been knocking them out as I can do them after work and such, and with their schedules, because most of ours are at least 2 hours or so, are talking about the inspiration that came from punk rock, the drive, the DIY, and some of these people have excelled and pushed hardcore to a higher level because of what they learned. Other people took what they learned and put it into their work life, and that's more interesting for me to listen to. You know what I mean? Like, that's what I want. That's what I want to put on my headset and forget that I'm troweling concrete or chipping concrete all day. And that's kind of what I want to put out into the world. And then we'll mix it up with a couple, like, hey, quick updates, you know, and we'll take it from there. I'm not trying to get too crazy with it. But that's the ultimate goal.
That's awesome. So you're doing jiu-jitsu, you're pouring concrete, you're doing a podcast, you booked the This Is Hardcore Fest, you grow sunflowers in your backyard.
Love them. They're actually fucked up. I actually bought these things. They're so big, I have to tie the things up again. One's 15 foot already.
Craziness. Yeah, I see.
I've never had a backyard this big. Do you understand this? And I don't have a big backyard. I've got another house lot next to me. So we have like two city backyards would be, and the lot next to me. I think I'm a fucking farmer. Like, I don't know shit. Like, I like, you know, like, literally, somebody just got shot last Sunday. There was 30 bullets. Thank God I was picking my wife up. I didn't see it. Like, I have like a hood paradise right here. You know, like, I'm just happy that we have this. I never had a propane grill till this, my 40th birthday just had passed. My wife bought me one. Like, I think I'm living out in the suburbs. Really, it's still hood. It's still crazy. I'm still in the city. So, yeah, I always thought sunflowers were the coolest thing, and we drive on tour and see them. And I was like, yo, fuck it. I'll just see if I could grow them. And this is like year two of it.
That's awesome, man.
Whoa, thank you so much, man, for
Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for the questions. Thank you for prying into more than just the average stuff.
No, for sure. Yo, that's
obviously I love talking jiu-jitsu, so I appreciate that too.
That was my favorite part. So awesome, yo. Everything you said, everyone at my gym has been listening to my podcast, so they're going to listen to this and get so hyped. They're going to get really hyped.
I mean, and that's the support that you – I mean, that's another thing is Jared did that band Guillotine. We did their first show. 20 people from the school just came to see him and didn't understand what moshing was.
So good.
Then when we had all the tag team people there, when Guillotine played the fest, they stayed for Gulch and they were like, what the fuck is this? You know, but jiu-jitsu, you see it, you know, they're going to support everything everybody does. That's one of the best parts about the community, you know?
It's unity.
Yeah, it really is. It is a unifying thing across everything, you know?
100%.
Can't wait to listen to your podcast.
Yeah,
man,
I can't wait. I'll be listening to every episode.
My goal is to, by next Friday, to have all the on the internet so the first ones release. I just don't want to put out something. I did 3 podcasts this year that sounded bad. Like, I sounded like crap. And I'm like, I don't want it to sound like crap. So we're just making sure they sound good when we release them.
Amazing. I'll put up the link on our profile, whatever, man.
No, thanks. I really appreciate it. And, like, that's the other thing is, I also don't think enough people, like, people shout out, but we're going to try to make sure on our website link to link the ones we like, because there's so many of our friends that do them, but I think that people are like, oh, I'd like to listen to a new podcast, but they listen to true crime, and they could be listening to all these different hardcore people that do cool podcasts.
Yeah, 100%. So, yeah, I hope to see you soon at BJJ United if Bronx
I hope so,
to go.
And likewise, I mean, if Jared goes up to do a seminar, we'll definitely travel up just to have the experience, you know? Plus, I have not been to the Bronx since like 98, 99. So I'd love to see what it looks like now.
All right, man. Yo, thank you so much.
No, thank you so much. Yo, take care,
thank
bro.
Thank you, man.
Yo, peace.
Take care.